This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Think about a time when you were a kid when you did something bad. And I don't mean drawing on the walls with crayons. I mean a time you did something stupid, even maybe illegal. You probably knew it was wrong. Well, maybe you didn't at the time. Maybe you were a good kid and it was just something you did in the moment. The truth is, a lot of young people make bad choices. But the outcomes for kids, the consequences, that's where paths can diverge.
I tried to outrun a cop on my mini bike, and he caught me. So I had to go to juvenile hall and appear before a judge and everything. It was a bad thing to do.
I never faced any consequences for cutting class because I was in honors classes and got good grades. And even at that young age, was appalled by the inequality of enforcement.
The police started to follow me. I panicked. I took off and ended up totaling the car in a ditch. They arrested me, and the judge said to my father, "Is he a good kid?" My father said, "Yes." And they let me go with just a speeding ticket. If I had not been white at that time, my whole life would have been ruined by that event.
What happens when kids, impulsive by their very nature, commit crimes? This week, WNYC Studios kicked off a 9-part podcast looking at America's juvenile justice system, how and why some kids get caught up in it, and what it means to get labeled an offender. Around 50,000 teenagers are held at some kind of juvenile facility on any given day in this country. A lot of them are kids like Z, who isn't using his real name since he's under 18.
Every day I wake up, every time I go to sleep, I think about being locked up. I be having dreams.
The podcast is called Caught, and with me now is contributor Dwayne Betts, a poet and Yale Law School graduate who spent 9 years in prison for a crime he committed at 16. He's on the podcast. And here's Kai Wright, host of Caught from WNYC Studios.
We're really primarily taking listeners into the lives of the sorts of young people who end up in the juvenile justice system. So often when we talk about criminal justice, period, we don't talk to people who are actually experiencing the problem. We talk about them. We don't hear from them. And we reduce them to their crimes. We reduce them to the things they're at risk for. And so what we're doing in this series is backing up from that and really meeting these young people, hearing their stories from them, and learning that it's much more complicated when we think about what their problems are and what they need.
I get locked up and I'm doing time. And I remember standing in front of the judge and seeing everybody inside the courtroom. And I just picture myself being remanded. They putting those tight handcuffs on me and bring me to the back room and lock me in the cell.
How often do you have these thoughts?
Every day. Every day I wake up.
Now, we should say, though, this isn't about guilt or innocence. This isn't about taking a juvenile offender and saying, oh, they're not culpable because they were 16. It's not really about that at all.
That's right. No, I mean, everybody in this podcast has been convicted of a crime. Whether or not they committed the crime is not the debate. The question that we're pursuing is, okay, so now what? So we have decided that a 12-year-old is guilty of a crime. What do we do with that in society? And is what we're doing currently, which is just punish them with more and more intensity, is that appropriate?
Dwayne, you are one of the lives that Kai is talking about. You're not a subject of this series, but you're part of it. You spent 9 years in prison for a carjacking when you were just 16 years old. Can you tell a little bit of that story, what led up to it, and what came afterward for you?
Yeah, no, I mean, honestly, and this is probably the tragic truth and probably the tragedy of the whole series, is that the story is a short one. I mean, it took 30 seconds for me to pull out a gun and rob somebody. I got picked up the next day. I pled guilty, and I found myself at 16 facing life in prison. And I think that the key, though, is that if you choose to describe me as an offender, if you choose to describe me as the kid who carjacked somebody, what you do isn't focusing on just guilt. You, like, block out all sense of potential. And though I faced life in prison, the judge knew, and probably the prosecutor and my attorney, they knew from the start that I wouldn't get life. And my judge, he said, I'm under no illusion that sending you to prison will help. Then he sentenced me to 9 years. And again, his sentence was based on this urgent need to punish, excluding all else, and excluding even a cognizance of like what might happen to a young person in prison. And so, you know, that whole situation let me know that whatever potential, whatever light might be on the end of the tunnel was for me to discover, because nobody in the room that day imagined me to make it where I am now, except my family.
Now, at the time of this crime, though, Duane, right, you were in the Honor Society.
Yeah.
I mean, was any of this part of the court's evaluation of you or the judge's evaluation of you? Did any of this enter into how the judge or the system, I'll say, thought about you as an offender?
The strange thing is I got incarcerated when I was in 11th grade. I ended up graduating from high school when I was 16 because I had enough credits to graduate early. So I tell people I skipped the 12th grade and went to prison. and you know, but the joke of it is that didn't matter to the prosecutor. It didn't matter to the judge. We didn't have a system, really, that allowed them to care about those things. And so I don't even want to act as if they were the problem. We literally did not have a system that allowed them to ask those kinds of questions. We didn't have, I remember my first attorney, the one that my mother fired, told her that I would be lucky if I could get into community college. Now I got a degree from the best law school in the world. And we still don't really have a system that fundamentally imagines me to be possible.
And I think what's interesting is that, you know, Duane talks about this in the podcast, is that we look at Duane's stories like that, and we like to say, oh, look at the reform that's possible. Look at all that he has done for himself. And it's a feel-good story of somebody who redeemed himself. And I think it's important to stop and turn that around and look at it the other way. You know, is it, yeah, sure, Duane has done amazing things with his life, but the real question is, why didn't the system see that in the first place? You know, why did it have to be in spite of
right.
the system?
I was going to say not because of, but in spite of.
Right.
I think, honestly, the fundamental problem is that we, once you get put in a certain box, we are unable to think about you outside of that box. And so that box starts with, like, you committed a crime. And we like to think that it's just the murder, the body in the street. But I think what court shows is that same type of mentality starts with being accused of shoplifting. It starts with a fight in sixth grade, like the same mentality, the same putting a young person in that box, and typically a young person of color in that box. It starts so young that it becomes almost an inescapable trap for a lot of people.
Today is April 1st. I've been here at least a month, transferring from different facilities. I've been to juvenile centers. I've been to Rikers.
Picture somebody constantly poking you. You holding all your energy inside, not speaking to nobody. Sooner or later, you're just going to burst.
Now, Kai, you have Duane along with you to tell these stories, but tell me a little bit about Z's story, because he is the young man, the juvenile, whose interaction with the system didn't start at 16 or 15, I think 11 or 12.
Yeah, the first time he had handcuffs on him was for truancy at the age of 12, and the first time he found himself in lockup waiting to see a judge was at 13. And that was literally for a schoolyard fight. That was literally because he got into a fight on a schoolyard, and his school is next door to a police precinct in a neighborhood that is labeled as a place with high crime, and so it has a zero-tolerance policing attitude. And when the kid he got in a fight with, instead of going to the principal's office, went to the police station, they arrested him and treated him like a hardened criminal. And that was the beginning of his saga. So there's that part of it, which is like we can see the way in which this really aggressive zero tolerance attitude, both in terms of school discipline, it's true in our schools, and in terms of policing in our neighborhoods, which is so often directed at young men of color. But the other part of Z's story that I think is interesting is that no one's acting like Z was okay. Z, like many of us in our childhood and in our adolescence, needed help. He had issues. He had some mental health challenges, not profound ones, but real ones, and he needed help. And in the times in his life when he was getting that help, he was excelling. And when he didn't get that help, his life would get more complicated. And what is, I think, probably most tragic about his story is that when he really got the most help was only once he was inside the criminal justice system. That's the only time when he finally could get the help he truly needed. And that is a perversity, you know, because now the help comes with punishment and with a label that is forever going to define him.
It's important to note, though, that the point is not that we should see the young person as possibly committing a serious crime, but what we should see them as is somebody who is profoundly calling out for help, and imagine what that help should look like outside of the punitive model that we only use. I mean, I spent nearly 6 years in prison before I talked to a psychologist or a psychiatrist.
Well, Duane, I wanted to ask you about that once you went into prison at 16 years old, whether there was anything in place for you to help change your direction. Now, you say it took 6 years before a mental health professional talked to you. And in the interim, were you like any other inmate? Were you on a path to be in and out of prison, do you think, for a very long time?
2 points. Again, like, I pushed back against the kind of language that we use that frames people as like inmates, convicts, prisoners. And I pushed back because, you know, right after graduating from Yale Law School, I had a spate of stories about me, and every story needed to say ex-con graduates from Yale Law School, as if my distinguishing feature was ex-con, right? But I talked to a mental health professional for 10 minutes before they excused me from the office because I challenged the fact that they waited 6 years to talk to me. And I asked what trauma he think I might have experienced over that 6 years and why it was only at this moment that he found a need to call me into his office. And so he refused to engage with me. So the truth is that I had no mental health treatment while I was incarcerated. And I wasn't on a path of recidivism, and I wasn't on a path of reoffending. I was actually on a path that men in prison helped put me on, and that I helped put myself on, in the sense that, you know, I decided that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in prison. And I looked around and I saw a lot of people who were going to spend the rest of their lives in prison. And I had some resources that other people didn't have. And I was able to take advantage of those resources with the support systems that I was able to build. But I'm still really reluctant to act as if just because you got this body of people that are incarcerated, that they are somehow like headed for future violence, more violence, or a life of crime. I think the point is that we put measures on them afterwards. We make it more difficult to get a job. We make it more difficult to get housing. We make it more difficult to get an education. And that those things help exacerbate already the profound trauma that folks have already experienced. I mean, I've had full tuition scholarships taken from me from Howard University. You know, I've had all kinds of things happen post-incarceration that have made my success unlikely. And those are things that have been beyond my control. And that's even worse when you get labeled as a felon and you're only 16 years old. And it gets worse when you get the stigma that comes with having a juvenile conviction. Because even though people don't know about it, a lot of people in schools and a lot of the systems that these young people deal with do know that they've been incarcerated. If you are in the seventh grade and you miss 2 months of school, everybody is aware that you've been locked up. Yeah. And when you go back to school, they treat you accordingly.
Yeah. Not to mention the damage done inside detention. I mean, that's, again, one of the stories that comes up in our podcast is that it's not only do you have to, if you do need help, not only do you not get it until you get inside, once inside, it is itself damaging. It is scarring to your mental and emotional health. And some people make it through that okay. Some people are strong enough to, as Duane says, figure out for themselves how to emerge from it healthy. A lot of people are made unhealthy by the experience.
Take a slice of this. Who's doing it right?
One, a lot of states have been moving towards closing some of their juvenile detention centers. And in closing some of their juvenile detention centers and decreasing the population of young people locked up in these detention centers, I think it's created space to have more programming for people who actually have challenges. I know that I've been to detention centers across the country, really, that have tried to bring more educational programming into those centers, that have tried to bring more outside guests, that have tried to work with the community more. You have more alternatives to incarceration that are being put in place across the country. I think the point, though, is that first, we're talking about a different system for every state in the country, and so it's really hard to just highlight one system. And second, the fact that I can't highlight just one place and say this is the model is the other challenge, because we could highlight policies that show us how we got into this situation, but we can't highlight like this is the model place to show us how we get out of it. But I will say that, you know, you got states across the country from like New York to Virginia to even here in Connecticut that have been doing some great things with young people in terms of trying to lower the rate of incarceration for juveniles. And in terms of trying to increase the program and increase the opportunities, the problem is that we haven't done enough. And the problem is that there isn't enough awareness of what is actually working.
That's contributor Duane Betts, poet and lawyer from Yale, and host Kai Wright of the podcast Caught. The third episode is out today. It's part of a 9-part series from WNYC Studios.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.